today is Wednesday, May 15th. Today was bike to work day, bike to school day, bike commute day in downtown Northampton with free bike breakfast across from the courthouse. And in honor of Bike Week, I'm going to play some bike songs today. Also mixed in with the rest of today's show is Alex Stewart, a continuation of last week's show when Alex Stewart was talking about his Hudson Valley walk that he did a few years ago, and he interviewed lots of people about climate change and stuff like that. Oh, and I should also say the show, if you're interested in the show that was playing before I interrupted it, the recorded show, that episode was, you can listen to that episode and pretty much almost all of the past episodes of Out There online at weatherbeard.com/out there. And that episode, I think, was from January 2019. So I'm going to play this song, Katie Malua, and then we'll hear from Alex soon.
And it turns out that...
Oh, no.
Achieve that?
No, sorry. We're still having difficulties because I don't know where all the sound is coming from. So let me just go back to automation here.
Hi, Timmy. Thanks for the calendar. That was sweet. Yes, it reminds me of my Kentucky home. I especially like the picture of Sally and Ellen from Egan making soap, 1982. Egan's about 8 or 10 miles away from where I grew up. I would have been 8 years old in 1982 and probably doing the same thing, making soap, making cheese, making rope, or rather helping my dad do those things.
Sorry for all the chaos, but wow, such a crash landing. No one can ever Here we go. Say it's true. But I know that I will always be with you. I'm warm by the fire of your love every day. So don't call me a liar. Just believe everything that I say. There are 6 billion people. More or less, and it makes me feel quite small, but you're the one I love the most of all. To Alex Stewart and his Hudson River Walk. This episode is online at weatherbeard.com/music/Hudson, something like that. Yeah.
Life works on this planet that every part of the web of life contains.
I stayed that night with Lori Gross and family. Here's her daughter, Fiona Fraser Gross.
Okay, my thoughts on climate change is it's bad and it's real, and we need to stop it from happening because all the polar bears are dying, and they don't like that. Mm. It makes me feel kind of frustrated, because it seems so, like, simple that the right thing to do is to just make it go away, but it's not that easy. And I like having snow in the winter, and we didn't this year, so that was very frustrating. Mm-hmm. We went to a really big climate change march in New York City, and there were so many people there, and that really gave me hope, because just seeing that so many people really care is really empowering.
A short walk down the road was the farm of Ethan and Dayami Soloviev. Here's Ethan.
I mostly experience the shift in the climate as an activating force for me right now. It feels like it fills me with excitement and energy to move and to take things on and to try bigger stuff than I've tried before. And I think that coming from a permaculture background has really inspired me towards positive action through design, especially through landscape and food and agriculture. And so I see such potential and possibility in actually changing the trajectory of climate change, actually doing mitigation work through large-scale regenerative agriculture. Like, I see it. It's possible. And it also, even if we don't totally shift things back in the other direction, moving towards regenerative agriculture will have huge adaptation benefits everywhere it happens. My consulting company, TerraGenesis International, has been working with Lush Cosmetics, which is a big international cosmetics brand. And they've asked us to work with them to make it so that their entire global supply chain, millions and millions of dollars, everything that they purchase to go into their cosmetics, is coming from regenerative permaculture organic farms around the world. And so we've helped them to set up an investment fund that invests millions of dollars into scaling up permaculture farms and helping more traditional farms go towards organic and permaculture all over the world. And it just feels like such a leverage point, you know, rather than just doing a single thing on my land or for an individual client working at that systemic level, they like see it and see how it could be applied through their whole business globally. And they're teaching all the people, their, you know, 8,000 employees about permaculture and simple positive actions they can all take. So it just feels like a juicy leverage point.
I asked Ethan, how do you support workers to be capable in this area?
I've been very focused recently on developing personal agency and like a personal sense of will around this work, around positive systemic change. So it's less about like having taken a permaculture class or a holistic management class it's less about the content and more about the energized, like, personal belief and confidence in oneself and in what I can do and accomplish, even if I have no clue how to do it. That's really, I'm looking for people who are like, yeah, that sounds awesome. I don't know what to do. Let's figure it out. It's more like that kind of being state that I'm excited about. And so our whole company does a couple different sets, but does ongoing personal and professional development work. Some from the co-counseling perspective, some from a different school that I'm part of that's connected to a woman named Carol Sanford and the Regenerative Business Institute. And they're consistent ongoing development processes where people commit to growing themselves in order to achieve some big systemic change in the world. Not, they don't work on themselves in order to make their life better. They don't work on themselves to like have a nice home or like have a business that works, though those may come out of it. We're like aiming for some bigger change in a specific system in the world. And it turns out that we have to grow as people in order to achieve that. And so there's sort of an interplay between like seeing a big system that needs shift and development and making a promise beyond what we're currently able to do and then having to grow to get there. You know, we're sitting here, I'm watching our beehives thriving, I'm hearing our chickens in the background, we're sitting next to our garden, I'm looking out into the woods where I've been sitting and listening and wildcrafting food. And so I think there's a, it's not a requirement, but everything will go a lot better and faster if there's ecological immersion, if there's like a ecosystemic, eco-social immersion into place and ecology and human ecology and human history of each person's place. Mm-hmm. So that's sort of, yeah, that's an invitation. If you ain't doing that already, get to it. I think it'll help.
Here's his partner, Diami Soloviev.
It depends on the day. For sure. One thing that I'm like super aware of in more of a like intellectual way, even than a like real felt or experiential way, is how much my life is buffered from it, from the harshness of it. I think, yeah, just living rurally in the Northeast, like specifically where we are, in a like predominantly white community, white middle class community, I feel like really blessed, because like it's a blessing and a curse. Like my life can kind of go along without a lot of severe daily interrupt in terms of like health and wellness and happiness and like living the life that I want, creating the world that I want in like my little reality. But yeah, I think like I feel blessed and like I feel grief about that as well. And I think I'm only like just like definitely through the like strength that RC offers me, allowing myself to look in the places that are experiencing the like are on the front lines more.
Can you say what RC is?
Yeah. Reevaluation counseling basically allows me to look and feel the feelings that come up when I look, mm-hmm. and like encourages me to cry about it when that's what I want to do in response to it, because it's so intense. And similarly, I think it makes so much sense, the RC perspective about why this why so many of us are so frozen around doing anything about this. Us all having been young people who like weren't able to make the big changes in our lives that we wanted to make happen, being faced with this big thing that needs to change, it makes sense that we feel all the feelings of discouragement and powerlessness and all of those things when thinking about what to do to approach this big thing. Mm-hmm. Like in response to having been a discouraged, burnt out activist as a teenager, I decided to go really personal and small, and like focus on my life and changing my life in ways. I think it's really just recent that I'm like starting to think about like, okay, what would that mean? Like pushing myself even a little bit further. And certainly leading in an RC context feels like
a step in that direction to like support people to reflect on their feelings that come up when thinking about these kinds of things. Feels like a leverage point for change for sure. Mm-hmm. I think I like my material makes me struggle between like wanting a kind of like small life versus like having a really big life.
What do you mean by material?
My like my hurts. Mm-hmm. My like the ways that like I haven't fully healed from my early hurts. Basically like fear holds me back. Mm-hmm. I remember there was a period of time that was like totally grief filled around kind of like the bigness of the problems of the world, where I used to say, I just want to live a really small life. Mm-hmm. but I can see that was like pretty fully me, like in my material, and not like thinking big and thinking of like potential and thinking of my gifts. And
inspired by people who are making big change in the world, I wondered how I can ask questions to help people think about the action they can take without actually telling them what to do. I did some interviews where I would awkwardly spend a whole minute just trying to get a question out in the right way. I felt like such a dork. Here's a question I had for herbalist Anne-Marie Tedeschi from New Paltz.
I'm trying to find a question that's not trying to tell people, not trying to like tell people that they should be an activist, right? Mm-hmm. But I'm trying to say, well, what if you think about being an activist in this area? Mm-hmm. What comes up?
Well, I do consider myself an activist on some level, and I have actually done environmental work, but yeah, I mean, right now, I don't have, like, my full time to devote to it, because I'm doing a lot of other things, and I guess, really, what's standing in the way of being, like, a full-on, like, all the time, full-time environmental activist, devoting everything to it would be society paying rent and having to partake in the money system and having to go to work and drive to work, you know. That's like another big thing. It'd be nice that not to have to drive to work, but here we don't really have a public transportation system that takes us everywhere. So,
I think for most people, it's just asking them where they're at is probably the best thing to do, and don't try to. I feel like as soon as I try to go to that question of what more you could do, it's like pushes people, and people, I don't know if you felt like mm-hmm. you were being criticized or like
no.
It was a, you know.
No, I just wasn't really sure how to answer.
Yeah, yeah.
No.
A fox just ran across my path.
I'm going to interrupt this for just a minute. You're listening to Out There on Valley Free Radio. I'm your host, Ruthie Woodring, though today, actually, Alex Jarrett is more like the host. He's playing a podcast he did from a walk in the Hudson River Valley a few years ago and interviewing people about climate change. And since this week is Bike Week, I'm going to play a few bike songs. So I got a bike song, and then the rest of the show with Alex.
Que te escribí, que te sueñe, que te quiero tanto, que hace rato está mi corazón. caminando relajada entre la gente. Yo te quiero así y me gustas porque eres diferente.
A mi manera, despelucado, en una bici que me lleva a todos lados. Un vallenato desesperado, una cartica que yo guardo donde te escribí. Te sueño y que te quiero tanto, que hace rato está mi corazón latiendo por ti, latiendo por ti. Aquí yo guardo donde te escribí. Que te sueño y que te quiero tanto, que hace rato está mi corazón latiendo por ti, latiendo por ti. Es la favorita, la que canta la zona. Se mueve en su cadera como un barco en la sola. Tiene los pies descalzos como un niño que adora. Y sus cabellos largos son un sol que te antoja. Le gusta que le que la miren cuando ella baila sola. Le gusta más la casa que no pase las horas. Le gusta Barranquilla, le gusta Barcelona.
Lleva, llévame en tu bicicleta. Óyeme, Carlos, llévame en tu bicicleta. Quiero que recorramos juntos esa zona, desde Santa Marta hasta la Arenosa. Lleva, llévame en tu bicicleta, pa' que juguemos por la tapa y en chancleta. Que se pique algún día le muestras en Tayrona. Después no querrá irse pa' Barcelona.
A mi manera, descomplicado, en una bici que me lleva a todos lados. Un vallenato desesperado, una cartica que yo guardo donde te escribí. Que te sueño y que te quiero tanto, que hace rato está mi corazón latiendo por ti, latiendo por ti. Aquí yo guardo donde te escribí. Que te sueño y que te quiero tanto, que hace rato está mi corazón latiendo por ti, latiendo por ti.
Óyeme, Carlos, llévame en tu bicicleta. Que se pique algún día le muestras en Tayrona. Después no querrá irse pa' Barcelona. Lleva, llévame en tu bicicleta. Óyeme, Carlos, llévame en tu bicicleta. Que sea mi pique, tú le muestras en Tayrona. Después no querrá irse pa' Barcelona.
That was Shakira and Carlos Vives. My translation of that song was, I love you and I love bikes and we can go anywhere on a bike. All right. You're listening to Out There on Valley Free Radio. And this is Alex Jarrett continuing with his podcast from his Hudson Valley walk a few years ago, interviewing people about climate change.
So I was creeping out toward the road and then
the fox
bolted as soon as it saw me. Boy, this is not a common way to travel in these parts. The amount of ignoring that's going on is pretty intense. In the 10, 11 miles I've walked so far, one person has spoken to me. I've said hello to some people, but they've never actually initiated anyone. No one else has ever initiated anything or talked any further than just hello. I have only seen a few people, too. I mean, if you don't count people in their cars or in their houses. And then that person, I was like, oh, I should have taken more opportunities, but I really had to poop, and there was just nowhere to go. And of course, I could have maybe made friends with this person enough to ask to use her bathroom, but that's somehow it's hard to do when you're not relaxed. You just want to, like, get, you know. So, anyway, I found a patch of woods far enough away from a stream, dug a hole, so feeling a bit more relaxed now. It was really nice to stay last night at Anne Marie's house and talk with her housemate Frankie for a while, and just listen to him and share and just remember that I've done some cool things with pedal people and cooperative living and buying a house together, and that sharing all those things is really useful for other people. So I think actually he came away a bit inspired. Very cool to be doing this, even if it feels stupid sometimes. Here's a little song I made up while walking on these narrow roads. It goes, these sight lines are bad for walking, and I'll tell you what they'll do. One of these days your luck will run out and a truck will run over you. This is always a magical moment. I'm about to arrive at my host's place, and just looking at the house numbers and trying to guess, oh, what will this house be like? What will they be like? Never even met them before. I hope they're safe. Hopefully I'm not in the wrong town. There's a bicycle, that's a hopeful sign. There's chickens, that's a hopeful sign. I think here we are. I had a lovely visit with Sarah Scott and her family. We spoke for a while, and the conversation turned to the question of what to do next, or how to do more.
I even kind of feel uncomfortable asking the question, because I don't want any pressuring anyone. Mm-hmm. Like, part of one of my goals is to try to figure out how to help people come to a place where they're doing things from their heart, and not because they feel guilty or because they're coerced.
Right.
But I'm not quite sure how to do that.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And the first thought I've had is just listen to people, just ask them, or mm-hmm. maybe ask them about the times when they did something and burned out on it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so a lot of people actually have a history of like, oh yeah, I'm going to fight for this cause, and then they burn uh-huh. out on it, and that kind of sours them on, you know, because then figuring out how to do it in a sustainable way.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I went down to Washington in 82 for the Equal Rights Amendment protest. And that was fun. I mean, but I was young, too. That was after my freshman year in college. So, but I've never really felt like an urge to do something like that. So I just haven't done that. So there hasn't been something that I did that turned me off, or that I just ran out of energy to do it. I just haven't put my mind to doing that, mm-hmm. that kind of activism work.
The next day was my last day of walking. Earlier, I walked by a power plant and then right across giant generating station, many, many stories high, with all sorts of signs that said no trespassing or loitering. I was like, how can you loiter if you can't trespass? But I think that meant don't even think about loitering outside the fence here. Probably for security purposes. And then right across the street from the generating station was this old church. Beautiful church, beautifully maintained. And it just seems so out of place. And I wondered what, you know, was this a community before the generating station? Why would you build this church, you know, seemingly in the middle of nowhere across from... Obviously, the church was there first. And now I've come up a hill and walking past all these mansions that overlook the Hudson. And I'm just trying to come to terms with, you know, crazy inequality. And of course, when I think about that, I think about, well, what's the inequality in my life? And of course, there is a lot if you think about it on a global scale. And what can I do, or more likely, like, what's in my way of becoming more compassionate? And 'cause it's probably similar to what's in the way of these people. So I'm pretty disgusted right now. Also, earlier, one young man was driving, and was going incredibly fast on these narrow roads and just like zoomed past. And I was just trying to think about like the arrogance, the danger, you know, how bad does he have to feel to behave like that? Sort of
the question that comes to my mind, because that's how I think about when people are reckless and are endanger others and themselves. And what does it do to a person to be raised with this wealth? Today I'm thinking about the privilege to be ignored. Like if I were a woman, or if I were a black person, or younger or older than I am, I might not have that privilege. I mean, I kind of don't like it. I don't like that I'm just generally ignored as I walk through here. But it's probably a lot better than getting a lot of unwanted attention.
After the long 2-mile walk over the Newburgh Bridge, passing the toll plaza and seeing it from a new perspective as a pedestrian, I walked into Beacon, New York, my last stop before taking the train into New York City. I think back to this period of my life, more than 2 years ago, and how insecure I felt on this walk. I don't think the people I met would see me this way. And that's the difference between action and feelings. Sometimes when I take the biggest actions, I feel the worst. I stayed in Beacon with Petra Aldrich, who works at the United Nations.
What I think about climate change, professionally and in terms of where I sit literally, it's fascinating to see the entity that is the UN system attempt to actually deal with climate change when so much of it is driven by commercial interests, consumer interests, that direct governments more powerfully than the UN really can. And personally, I find it really, really difficult to think about. Very just emotionally difficult. I was joking with you last night and saying that, you know, I currently do work in the area of landmines, explosive hazards, active conflicts, and, you know, I have, for whatever reason, the emotional coping mechanisms to deal with this subject matter of, like, laser, hush. Children getting their legs blown off or whatever, that I can cope with. I used to work in anti-human trafficking, that I can cope with. But, like, show me a drowning polar bear and I can't get out of bed for a week, you know?
What brain gives you hope in this area?
Oh, goodness. People like you, I think. And maybe that's something I need to focus on more. Yeah.
I have an exercise for you.
Okay.
Let's imagine it's 50 or 60, 70, whatever years in the future. Mm-hmm. You know, your children or grandchildren are around, and we've made it. Mm. We figured out how not to have at least be catastrophic. You know, obviously, there's a lot of challenges.
Yeah.
Would you have any words for them?
Good job, is what I'd say.
Yeah.
You know, if we'd actually managed to pull it off. Amen. Thank you. Well done. How did you do it? I would imagine that they would say to us, how'd you let it get so bad? I thought you were going to ask, what does it look like? And so that's what I was thinking more about. And I'm like, oh, I don't know, electric cars, everyone telecommuting, so there's less need to drive. I don't know. When I was a kid, like in preschool, our kindergarten and it was time to like talk about my feelings, I would run away and hide under the bookshelf and like not come out till that part of the day was done. Mm-hmm. And I would say as an adult, I no longer literally run and hide under the bookshelf. But it's definitely something I struggle with.
Yeah,
no, in terms of articulating the feelings, I feel very sad and frustrated and hopeless a lot of the time. Yeah. It is helpful to live in a community like Beacon where there's a lot of awareness of climate change and a lot of people who are exploring community-based strategies. Having access to things like farm shares and locally sourced food, I think of that as being part of environmentalism, of living environmentalism. But now that I'm thinking about that more, I may want to interrogate that assumption a bit. Since, I don't know, how the logical chain of causality between me growing my own tomatoes or whatever and less fracking is not quite articulated in my head. And this is where you see this is where my professional training is really coming through. So, you know, we talked about monitoring and evaluation yesterday, but the foundation of all of that is results-based program planning. So in the way I think about everything, I think about creating the ultimate goal, the change you want to create in the world, and the working backward to what you can do to create the smaller changes that are going to have a bigger effect and eventually lead you to creating that change that is your goal. So the articulating the causal logic part of your goal in undertaking this project is to help people come to terms with their feelings about climate change so that they can take action from in a positive and productive way. To which I say, amen, that is awesome. Let me know what solutions you come up with, because I am basically your poster child for climate change guilt-based paralysis.
I left Petra's place and sat by the shore of the Hudson with Air Nonkin.
So my name is Air Nonkin, and I live here in Beacon, New York. And I have such an incredible respect for the world, you know, and like our role and responsibility in it. And that's why I started researching climate change when I was... I mean, I started getting into it when I was in middle school, honestly, because even at that time, I was starting to see the effects of the changing climate, just in the stories of like the old people in my little farm town. You know, they would share that the snows used to last longer and you know, they used to stick around longer. And then I used to really, my brother played hockey, and so I used to really love ice skating on the farm ponds. And then by the time I was entering high school, the ponds weren't freezing over enough to skate on in the winter anymore. And I was like, wait, what? You know, maybe it's just a warm winter. And then I noticed like, no, really, we can't skate on the ponds in Connecticut anymore. And that was just such a drastic change in my like very short lifetime, you know? And the fact that everyone, you know, in town who'd been there for forever were sharing like, yeah, this was the first year that we couldn't skate on the ponds. Mm-hmm. We were already, by the time I was, you know, 14, 15 years old, living in a world that no one had lived in before. And no one really knew what to do with that. No one knew how to live in this new world. And so I started really looking not so much at the science of it, but at the ethics of it. Looking at what is our responsibility? You know, what is our moral responsibility? And then just our logistical responsibility, you know, what are we as the stewards of the earth and as the people who have the mental capacity as animals to understand the effect that we're having, required to do? What is the current reality of the impacts that we're seeing now and today on climate? And what are the actual realistic projections? You know, not the doomsday, you know, people freaking out. and not the naysayers, but the best science and community understanding that we have on what climate change is currently doing and will soon be doing. And it was terrifying. At the time, I was living in Australia, and they were already seeing temperature shifts of about 2 degrees Celsius in many communities, you know, hotter. And, yeah. And that's a drastic change. And they were already seeing health impacts of many more people, especially elderly people, infants and infirm people were experiencing incredibly increased rates of heat stroke, heat stress, and heat-related illnesses and deaths. And this isn't a developed country. You know, this isn't a place where they have one of the best medical and healthcare systems in the world. And people were dying because of the heat. Mm-hmm. And the desertification and drought that was resulting, they didn't even have the infrastructure to bring water to Melbourne, one of the key cities on that continent, was facing a massive and immediate water shortage. They were down to something like, I can't remember exactly the numbers, but it was below 30% of the necessary water reserves. And then it kept going, and it kept dropping lower and lower, and the rivers were drying up before they got to the city. And so that what was really cool about doing that climate change study in that context was that no one was denying the reality of climate change and its immediate impacts. And so to be able to engage in that study and in that conversation in a community that was looking for solutions. They had gotten past all the rest of the bullshit, and they were looking for realistic, implementable solutions. Was really reassuring to think that, you know, that once a community and a government rallies around the reality of our situation, that we can move to that place of finding actual solutions. And so that's one of the reasons that I moved here to the Hudson Valley, because I saw that there's a real willingness and an activism here, focused on really trying to find ways of integrating change into the actual daily lives of the communities, and having that change exist on all levels, from, you know, education in the school systems to legislation on the, you know, city and state level. And that's what really needs to happen to be able to shift our practices towards ways that are actually sustainable. And that's also why I joined the Beacon Conservation Advisory Council, because I see that so many of the people who are engaged in this work aren't willing to do the messy government side of it, because it's the part that's boring and it sucks and it's so frustrating because it takes so long for change to happen in government. But once we're able to get, you know, towns and cities and counties and states and federal governments to implement policies that require change and also respond to community needs, and also just leverage the resources that they have available, that's when we can really see change expand beyond just one household or one neighborhood or one wonderful initiative that has a great impact in the people it can touch, to really being able to be the kind of systemic change we actually need to address the systemic problem of climate change.
Can you say, like, on a personal level, what keeps you going? What support do you need that maybe you don't have? Or...
I think that... So what really keeps me going with the climate issue and with environmentalism is this. It's the beauty of this place that we live. And it feels holy in a way. It feels like there's... there's a really special quality to this region. And it's not that this region is any more important to protect than any other region, but for some reason I find it so much easier to care about this landscape and about this river. And it's irrational, but I also have... It also comes from a place of fear. It comes from a place of wanting to make sure that we have the land and the water and the food that we're going to need for the rest of my lifetime and for the rest of, you know, the family I hope to have in the future and all of that. If I'm not as... I see a real potential for failure. You know, I see that I've lived around the world in many developing contexts, and I see what it looks like when we don't have a water infrastructure. You know, when there isn't a waste management infrastructure, when there's no sanitary systems, and it's unlivable, and it makes people ill, and it makes people have very short lifetime. I see that as a realistic possibility in any community. As much as I don't try to act from a place of fear, I try to act from a place of optimism and positive hope. It definitely does, at the back of my mind, come from, we got to do this or who knows what else. Mm-hmm. And it's hard to say that also because that's not what is going to inspire change. You know, when people get scared, they shut down. And that's definitely the case for myself as well, but it's, I think we have to have that be part of the conversation in some way, even though it's challenging, because if people don't realize the actual potential consequences of inaction, then that inaction becomes permissible. And you know, it's not an option between between some soft option A and soft option B. You know, it's a very important and dire consequences that we face, and so that has to be acknowledged. And because with dire consequences comes huge responsibility, and so I think we as communities have to take on the huge responsibility and the huge costs. I mean, making a lot of these changes is expensive, but it's not that it's an economic cost of, you know, let's say $1 million to make whatever change X, and you know, the cost of not doing change X is, oh well, you know, business as usual. It's in fact $1 million to do change X, or who the heck knows what terrible things, you know, 1 year down the line, 10 years down the line, 50 years down the line would result from not having made that shift. So it's a tough one.
Yeah. How do we make decisions about how to act in the world? What is effective? How do you know what your personal influence is in the world? How much information comes back to you? I suspect that very little of what we influence actually comes back to us directly. 16 years ago, I co-founded Pedal People, a worker cooperative that hauls trash, recycling, and compost by bicycle all year round. I was walking along the shore of the Hudson and ran into Sarah Womer, who founded the company Zero to Go.
I'm Sarah Womer, and my company is Zero to Go in Beacon, New York. And we are an education-based waste management company. We have a compost pickup program that we do here in Beacon, all by bicycle, heavy-duty electric cargo assist, heavy-duty electric assist cargo trikes with custom trailers. We've got 60 homes, 8 businesses, and we've diverted 28 tons of material in 10 months, and we're growing. We've also handled zero waste events for the last 4 years.
And what are you working on now?
Right now, I am handling the garbage and recycling for Long Dock Park here in Beacon, which is owned by Scenic Hudson. And this is the only park in town that recycles, because we're here separating. Well, there's two kinds of cans. There's a garbage can and a recycle can. And if we don't, unfortunately, if we don't sort the recyclables out, then there's a lot of recyclables that end up in the trash. And we incinerate 65% of our garbage here in this county. So it's really important that we do this. It is so cool to meet you.
Yeah, you too.
I love Pedal People. I did the zero waste event stuff for 3 years, and I always dreamed of doing a bike-powered compost pickup program here. I've been living here for 10 years, and what you guys are doing is the future of waste management. You guys are the inspiration for every bike-powered program in the country, I think. I mean, because you do it all.
Yeah, it's good to hear. Sometimes, you know, you just sort of focus on what you're doing, and you don't see the impacts that happen elsewhere. So it's good. It's great to meet you and just sort of see this happening.
Getting like a little emotional, actually. It's hard work. You know, we're so often like, people don't understand. They don't want to think about garbage. And we think about garbage all the time, right?
Yeah.
And because nobody else is doing this, we have to do this. And there's so many more intelligent ways to handle this work. And, you know, it's really important to teach people You know, all this stuff was in the garbage. These are the fishermen who come down here every day. They need to know what goes where.
How many other people have been inspired by my actions that I haven't and will never meet? Meeting Sarah was a reminder to follow my dreams, to take action, and remember that my influence is far greater than I will know. I ended the walk with no clear course of action, but with a greater sense of what a narrow slice of people are feeling. Did my brief presence in these people's lives make a change? Perhaps my next step is to follow up and ask them, instead of waiting to run into them someday.
And that was Alex Jarrett talking about his Hudson Valley walk. You're listening to Out There here on Valley Free Radio. Thanks for listening today. Stay tuned for Democracy Now! Coming up at 5 o'clock. By the way, Alex Jarrett is running for 5th Ward City Councilor in Florence, Massachusetts, this fall. Mom's in Albuquerque, Pop's in Tennessee.